But the truth is, it is so rare that someone sits across the table from you and expresses any interest in anything going on in your life. Like, people will just open up. If you have genuine interest and, you know, you're trying to do something to help them or to understand them, almost, you know, almost universally, people love that.
Hey, welcome back, everyone, to the Business of Freelancing podcast, where we help you get better clients, make more money, and live a happier and a healthier life freelancing. I'm your host, Brennan Dunn, and today I've got a great and awesome interview with a longtime student of mine, Eric White. Eric is, you know, when he started, he was kind of the typical commoditized freelancer. Right now, he's doing a lot of really high-value business consulting. We dive into that transition, how he made that transition in the interview. But before we get to the interview, a few quick announcements that I want to make. So first off, if you've seen the site recently, you know that I've been going through a lot of both visual and structural overhauls. That's, again, doubleyourfreelancing.com if you don't know the website or haven't been there before. And one of the big things that I recently added was this freelance rate calculator. And what it does is it allows you to plug in your income goals for the year. So let's say your goal is to make $100,000, freelancing, and then it lets you enter in how you bill, your average, you know, whether you bill by the hour, by the week, by the day, by the project. You enter in all these different details, and then what it will do is it spits out a pretty little chart. I mean, everyone loves charts, right? It'll spit out a chart that shows you your forecast. Basically, you know, based on how you're doing now, what is your forecast over the next 5 years? But most importantly, it gives you a few ideas on, you know, if you're under your annual income goal, it will give you ideas on how to get there. And if you're over, it will, I mean, obviously that's a good place to be in, but it will show you things like, you know, how you can cut down on your availability and still maintain that target income. You know, I'm really proud of it. Honestly, it was a lot of crazy JavaScript math that I had to write, but definitely check it out. It's at doubleyourfreelancing.com/freelance-rate-calculator. So give it a look, and hopefully it'll be helpful. All right, so let's get right into the interview with Eric. All right, guys, I want to introduce you to Eric White. Eric is I've known him for a while. I mean, you're a DYFC-er two times now, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Right. And we've known each other for a while. And I'm actually, as of this recording date, it's now official. So Eric's going to be speaking at the conference in Stockholm about a lot of what we're going to be talking about in today's episode. So before we get into all of that, Eric, why don't you just take a few minutes? We're going to be talking biographically about you, but what's the kind of the 30-second Eric's career in a nutshell?
Right. So background is in developing business software. I like interacting with people probably a little bit more than I like writing code. So I ended up spending a lot of time on the business side of that and figuring out how to please, you know, both the people who pay for the software, the people who have to use the software, and then, you know, getting enough information from them so that I can provide meaningful requirements to a development team so that they can go away and build something that everyone's going to be happy with.
It's interesting that you say that you prefer people to code or working with people to code. Your background's in iOS, right? I mean, that's the technical background for you.
So in the last 3 or 4 years, that's been the technology that I've specialized in. Before that, I was, you know, I worked in Java and C++ and, you know, really any language that enterprise software may have been written in.
Basically, what we're going to be focusing on today is a lot of what you've been doing with this concept of jobs to be done and how you're applying that to consulting. But it seems like, I mean, when you say Java, C++, iOS, I mean, going from doing more technical coding work to what you're doing now is a pretty big leap.
Yeah, it feels like a really big leap for sure. In the transition, I bring up the, you know, just enterprise software and developing requirements because that was sort of my journey from doing that is, I sort of joke and I say that, if you write code, but you have the shred of ability and interest in talking to another human being, you tend to do a lot of, you tend to move more towards requirements or analysis or things like that. So that was a really key step for me in my journey of being interested in what really drives behavior and decisions among people.
So you were doing Java work, I assume, like I think most of us, or at least I was. And then you then you moved over, in your case, to iOS. I moved to Ruby, but Ruby was that predated, I guess, iOS in a way.
And I think so, yeah.
You know, what we're going to be talking about is how Eric does a lot of the consulting work that you're doing now is very focused on understanding your clients' customers, why they switch to them, why they switch off of them potentially. And, you know, it's very, very high level, very business focused, which to me is, like I just said, it's a very big jump. So walk us through that kind of the transition. Like, how did that happen? Because I know a lot of people listening, they want to get into more or less, you know, business consulting. Or they want to at least be involved officially in the business of their clients. I think we all do to kind of accidentally, really. I mean, we you know, if we're working with a client, we're probably at some point giving some advisory, level kind of info about what they should think about doing with, you know, this feature, how it might affect conversions or something like that. But I don't think we make it official. A lot of us don't make it like an official part of what we're doing. So you are now. I mean, that's what you're doing now. So what is that? How did that happen?
So I guess I'll try to be as short-winded as I can, but I would really describe the journey as I really liked the business side of things. And so I like to see a problem and know how to solve it. And so as the consulting firm that I was with, we started working with different businesses. I found it very unsatisfying for, you know, so for example, if I was working with a trucking company, for someone in the trucking company to sort of write down notes about how they wanted a system solution to work and bring that to me and ask me to engineer it, that was a very unsatisfying way of doing business, right? Because they're great at running a trucking company and I'm great at writing software. And so I felt like there was this real tension in, you know, we weren't really meeting in the right place. And so, you know, you can have conversations with people to say, you know, hey, I wish we were talking more about your problems than, you know, sort of your sense about, you know, how a solution should be developed. But, you know, the truth is that's usually a much messier process. And I think most businesses go through that process of, you know, moving more from being an order taker to, I think the way that I kind of described it is kind of moving up the value chain. And so, you know, rather than, you know, having the director of operations come to you with, hey, here's what I need to fix my problem, working more with the COO or the CEO to really understand what their business is struggling with, and then, you know, working more collaboratively with them and their team to figure out, you know, how the technology could be developed or the software could be enhanced or new software could be obtained to be able to solve those business problems. And I found that process to be satisfying. I liked the I don't quite know the right word. I'm going to use the word politics. I mean, I liked the, you know, figuring out what is motivating everyone and how to make sure everybody's getting what they need in any given situation, whether that's the, you know, the development team that ultimately needs something to build, or the, you know, the CEO who's trying to drive the business somewhere, or, you know, the COO who's trying to, you know, help the CEO get where they're trying to go.
So you just alluded to a little I'm assuming in that trucking example, there was some tension in the butting heads in terms of the architecture, I guess, of what you ended up doing. I mean, I think we've all been we've worked with some clients who are very, idea people, I guess is one way of putting it, who don't really get low level. You know, they don't want to get involved in the design of a system, or, you know, the kind of the details, I guess, of our work. But on the other hand, you do get clients who are like that. I mean, at least in my mind, what needs to happen if you do end up wanting to do more kind of this higher level, I like the political bit that you just mentioned, you know, this kind of higher level, more people driven consulting work is, I think, at least in my mind, part of my qualifying now is ensuring that if I'm going to get somebody who's a micromanager, they're probably not going to be a good fit for me as a client. I mean, would you say that that's something that you've had to come to terms with, or?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a big part of why For me, charge what you're worth, DYFR, DYFC. The reason those things have been so valuable is, you really helped me articulate a struggle that I was already experiencing. And so I think before you and I met, I felt that tension, and it would really result more in me complaining to my boss or, complaining to my wife when I got home about just feeling frustrated about the situation. You really helped me articulate that. I think a lot of what it is, when it's more satisfying. I don't want to say necessarily, for me, it was more satisfying. It was also more valuable when you're playing in the problem space than when you're playing in the solution space. And so, a business can be very incented to say, hey, if we're good at designing a solution, the economy has changed and we can find somewhere anywhere in the world who can build us a solution. And now while we're commoditizing that service, and it's really just up to us to find someone that we can work with and get it done at the lowest possible cost. But when you're operating in the problem space and helping people understand problems, helping them even really understand what their problem is, and then being able to, articulate, understand, make sense of that, and then translate that into an even better solution, there's a lot of value there.
I mean, you went through Double Your Freelancing, right? And you started changing the way that you sold. Is that what led you to eventually do the kind of work you're doing now, this kind of jobs to be done style consulting? Or is that something that just kind of organically emerged out of, I assume at some point for instance, I came across jobs to be done because I was at a conference, business of software, and I forgot their names, but the two guys out of, I think, Chicago who coined it, I guess, or
yeah, Bob Mesta and Chris Speck with the Rewired Group.
Right. So they were speaking, and what I loved about their presentation was it was very interactive. So they brought somebody up on stage and they just, I think it was something about the last car they bought or something. And they just basically right. psychoanalyzed them basically on stage. And to me, it was really fascinating, right? It made total sense from the why, really understanding why people buy. And it's something that, to be honest, it's something that in a way it's a part of Double Your Freelancing, right? With the whole Socratic questioning stuff that I cover. I mean, it's the same. It's not like there's anything truly, it's not like there was this revelation that happened with Bob and the other guy. I forgot his name. But they really did a good job, I think, at making it a framework, making it something that's actually usable. I guess where I'm going with this is you went from going from being just kind of that commodity-ish technical consultant freelancer to getting involved, after going through Double Your Freelancing Rate and everything, getting involved in really focusing on the business of your clients and really articulating it a lot better than you were. And then the next jump is, I don't know if you want to say it's a niche or not, but you're focusing now on a specific offering, I guess, is what you're providing. You're not just providing open-ended development services anymore, right?
Yeah, I mean, almost exclusively not. I do still take on a couple of iOS development projects each year. I still love doing it, and it creates some nice opportunities and relationships for me. But yeah, what I'm really interested in is, to me, jobs to be done is really about it's a technique or a way of thinking that helps you understand, what's motivating people. And so you use the term studying switching behavior. And so what's really interesting to me about jobs to be done, and this tied back in with both, my experience doing, more business consulting, as well as, some of the things that you were talking about as you and I got acquainted, is that, what people say they're going to do is often very different than what they actually do.
Or the reasons that they say for making a decision is the surface level reasons are different than the actual reasons.
That's right. Yeah. And we're all guilty of that. And a lot of it is, we just don't sit around and think that much about what's really driving this thing. I feel frustrated in this situation. What's really under the hood of why I'm feeling frustrated? We just feel frustration, and we struggle to make that frustration go away. And so I like to think of jobs to be done as at a super high level is it's a way of understanding a struggle that a person is experiencing, observing that, identifying what the struggle is and understanding how they see their life as being better once that struggle is being resolved. And, I'm not trying to toot your horn, I guess, too much, but for me, it all kind of happened as I was in the midst of my own struggle of I'd been out on my own as a business person for about 9 months. I had a client that constituted about 80% of my business, and things were starting to go south with that client. And so I was really looking for, you know, I've got to do something new. That was a nice, safe place. And I was trying to figure out, you know, what am I going to do that I can kind of use to leverage? And so I found myself in the middle of this own struggle. And that's when I came across Double Your Freelancing Rate. And I thought, well, that sounds like something that I would really like to do. You know, if I could double my freelancing rate, I could.
Well, it's a very outcome-based title, right?
That is a very outcome-based. And so I started imagining, you know, what would my life be like if I were able to double? And, you know, the title was very evocative. But as I got into it, what I liked about what you talked about is, you know, this, you're not coming up with some way that you can manipulate or swindle someone. Your whole thing is about, hey, here's how you as a consultant can produce 10x value so that the people that you're serving, you're interested in what's motivating them. You really are understanding that, and you are able to leverage your own expertise to efficiently help them achieve what it is that they're going for. And so I was hearing you talk about that same thing at the same time I was being introduced to Bob Mesta and Chris Speck. And as they were talking about, you know, when customers are buying something, they've got something in their life that they're trying to fix, and they've got in their head, you know, something about how their life is going to be better afterwards. And so there's this real confluence of, you know, my own personal situation as well as, you know, people that I was starting to interact with that, you know, the light bulb really went off for me. And I was able to say, you know, I was able to sort of feel like, you know, especially with jobs to be done, I felt very much like I can take my experience of sitting with stakeholders and users and really, you know, kind of pushing on them and getting them to talk about their frustrations and observing, you know, what it is that they're trying to do that they're struggling to get done. And I can see those things and I can understand those and I can then translate those into a solution. I got very excited about, well, you know, Brennan is sort of coaching me to take that a very similar approach with my own customers. And it just really all started to resonate.
It's fun, I think, when you start to, like, in my mind, psychoanalyze, for instance, you know, double your freelancer rate, which we've been talking about, right? Uh-huh. So, yeah. You know, in my mind, it's funny, one of the most influential books for me that helped me as I was starting my agency and really getting good at pricing was a book called The Strategies and Tactics of Pricing. Very academic book, very much meant more for Fortune 100 CMOs and not kind of the average, let's say, consultant, right? So, but, you know, when you put the two titles together, I mean, in a way, look at blog articles that people click on, right? I mean, people click on the articles that will say something like, you know, how to do X or X reasons you should be whatever. You know, it's very, you know, what I've tried to do intentionally with Double Your Freelancing Rate. And I'd love to hear this in kind of from your perspective as a jobs to be done, you know, guru is, you know, I wanted, like you said, I wanted the outcome to be the outcome that I knew people wanted. Because people actually don't want to double their rate. They want what the effect of that is, which is being able to spend more time with their wife and kids or, you know, having more premium clients, which leads to more creative latitude or, you know, whatever, right? Like those are the end goals. And I didn't want to go, I mean, I could have gone as far as to, you know, work less time freelancing or something, right? I mean, that could have been the title, but I did keep it, you know, I didn't go that to that extent because I don't know what the goals are of a student of it. So, you know, that being said, but what you just hinted at, which is exactly right, which is, I think, true no matter, you know, no matter what you take away from this interview is it's, you know, when you get double your freelancing rate, it wasn't like a one page PDF that says just 2x whatever you're charging now. You know, it's really about how do you really double your product, I guess, so that you can justify a higher price point for it, right? So it's how do you go from being a basic freelancer to a hugely valuable consultant, right? Becoming, you know, it's not about I don't cover things. I don't recommend things like just go and take a lot of more classes on CSS or HTML or whatever. I mean, that does obviously, that's super helpful. I don't discount that at all. But the big thing that I saw, and I saw this in myself early on, was, you know, I had this idea that people were, and this I think harkens directly back to jobs we've done. I had this idea that people were paying me because they wanted code. right? I figured that's why there was a client relationship. You know, they were buying my ability to write code for them. And it wasn't until I really started to see that the code is actually pretty worthless when you think about it. It's what the code does, which is what's valuable. And when you're focused on the material instead of the effect, you know, there's kind of that disconnect. And what ends up needing to happen is it's up to the client to connect connect both dots, right? So if you're telling somebody how I'm going to build you a 5-page website, they need to internalize, okay, maybe this new 5-page website is going to get me the more customers that I need or something like that, right?
Yeah, so I think that's what you're saying is a great example. So I think probably anyone who's technical, who's listening right now, can identify with the struggle of, and like just how awful it feels when you have delivered a solution that totally meets a spec, but the customer is still dissatisfied. And that's just an awful feeling, and nobody likes that. And so what I feel like, you know, the jobs to be done idea is, you know, it really challenges one to look at the situation that someone, you know, let's just say it's a $50,000 mobile development project, which I've done several of those in my career. So when someone is going to, you know, when a company is going to pay that type of money and they're going to use someone from the outside, there's something that's going on in their business that's really driving that. So as a developer, if you just simply look at the specification that's provided from the customer and you deliver on that, you're really not connecting with them in the most impactful way. Usually when someone's doing that, you know, there are situations, I mean, this happened a number of times with trucking companies that I would work with where they've just gotten some huge new customer. They're not in a position where they're able to add additional staff. And so really what they're trying to do is they're trying to figure out, how can we take on this new customer without adding additional people to our dispatch staff? Because in their mind, they've calculated some return on investment of, if we can make all of this happen, you know, it's a 6 to 7 figure profit gain for our organization. And the mobile app that they're trying to get is simply a means to that end. And that's what I think, you know, so that's why I think like the farther up the value chain you go and the more human you make the clients and the more you're able to really understand, you know, the situation that they find themselves in, the better able you are to, you know, build features that are going to help them improve their situation. And honestly, also sometimes help them avoid features. You know, I've worked on projects where, you know, you're operating off of a specification and you've got this one particular feature that's become extremely difficult to get done. It's going to cost a lot more money. It's going to take a lot more time or whatever to get done. You know, and if you really understand a lot about what's really motivating the customer, then it's very easy to go back to them. If the feature is unimportant in the scheme of things, it's very easy to go back to them and say, like, look, I can save you all this money and time if you just kind of scrap this feature, and it's not going to help you get where you want anyway. And that's a case where, you know, everyone wins, and you've done something for the customer that's hugely valuable to them.
When you were saying that, what I was thinking about was one of the things that has helped me, and I use this example a lot when talking, especially with web designers or people who do web development work or whatever, is let's say somebody comes to you with a website redesign. I think that's the easiest one to use as an example, and here's why. If they're redesigning their existing website, they've made the mental decision to fire their existing website, right? So if you think of the website as an employee, if you think of the current way they're doing marketing as an employee, if you think about their current workflow for managing leads as an employee, if they're looking to do something new, they're effectively looking to replace that, you know, replace the person who was doing that
yes,
position, right?
That's right. So it's, yeah.
So yeah, I mean, until yep. you understand why did they fire their old employee and what are their expectations with the new employee, you risk something really potentially catastrophic, which is, you know, yes, you do a brand new website. Yeah, sure, it's newly designed. It looks great, blah, 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 blah. But if it still ends up having the same detrimental attributes that employee they fired before had, then, you know, I mean, and I think that's the big problem is the client is often going to think, well, what makes, why is the employee you're going to give me now so much better than the one that I have, you know, that I'm getting rid of? And when we come back and we say things like, well, we're using HTML5 and we're doing, you know, responsive design or, you know, something like that. There's that disconnect, right? It doesn't actually answer the question that they need answered.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. I've been reading Stephen King's autobiography called In Writing. I think it's on writing. And, you know, he talks a lot about this and, you know, nobody really cares about, you know, what Stephen King has in his writing toolbox as far as, you know, vocabulary or, you know, that he understands where there should be a comma or not a comma. I mean, you know, his mastery of the English language, we don't care so much about those technical details. We care about the stories that he produces. And, you know, I think there's like there's a nice parallel there. Another thing I was thinking about as you were saying that is, and this is something that I want to, you know, that I try to encourage people. So the jobs to be done language can be very powerful and evocative. And sometimes we do end up focusing a little bit too much on outcomes. So there's a there's this truism by Theodore Levitt that I hear people reference. I think he was the CEO of Black & Decker and a business teacher at Harvard. And he would say he's famous for saying, what's the quote? Customers don't want a quarter-inch drill. They want a quarter-inch hole in the wall. And I think that's kind of a gateway drug to really understanding, but I don't think it's quite right because really nobody wants a quarter-inch hole in their wall, right? They want a picture hanging on the wall or they want to get their projects done faster. So I think what I really encourage people is, you know, as you're going, like you have to dig down even farther than the outcome that someone's looking for and really figure out, you know, what's motivating, you know, what's happening in their situation that's really motivating that. And so, there's a guy, and I'm not going to remember his name, but he was the head of Revlon, and he used to talk about, you know, in the plants, we produce makeup. In the stores, we sell hope. And I feel like that's a very powerful way for all of us who are technically minded to really think about what it is that, the difference between what it is that we're selling, which we think of HTML5 or Objective-C, or, you know, now I've done this new training class and I don't do Objective-C anymore. I do Swift. And, you know, a customer doesn't care necessarily. They don't care about that. They care a lot more about, you know, what it is that they're hopeful is going to happen as a result of using whatever the technologist is going to build for them.
And I mean, I think they do care about it in the sense that let's compare it to building a house. I care about the quality of the craftsmanship and the materials that are going to the foundation of my house. But I care about it in the sense of what does it do to make it so my house has more longevity. Is more valuable for if I go to sell it, right? I mean, it's always, you know, my concern is what is the benefit of it, right? It's one thing for you to tell me that we're using, like, I was just actually, you know, I'm looking kind of at building a backyard studio shed thing for my office, and I was looking into this kind of like this construction DIY home improvement subreddit, and somebody was talking about, I think it was the difference between 2x4 and 2x6s or something, and how one of them is just so much better, right? It's so, you know, it was like, and I was just trying to think in my head, like, okay, so I think 2x4 means the inches for length and width, not length, but like width and depth. I'm very bad with that stuff, right? But it wasn't until somebody chimed in and said, and actually explained, I forgot which one, I think it was 2x6s are better, I think. But, you know, until somebody jumped in and actually explained how it actually, here's how it affects, you know, just the you know, what do they call it when the house temperature kind of regulates itself, you know, the insulation, right? Like, so, you know, he got into those sort of things. And then it started to me making a lot of sense. And I think, you know, the big thing, and I think this is where, and we've talked about this a lot on the show and everything, but I think from a jobs to be done perspective, what's really interesting to me, at least, is how can we use the skills that we're going to be applying on our client projects and turn them into benefits that align with the switching needs, right, that our clients have of us. So if they're firing their old website and they want to hire a new website, what are the actual business needs that are, you know, the requirements, I guess, that come with that new website? And then how can we translate our skill set to meet those ends?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, I try to be a little bit careful, you know, using too much insider baseball language when I'm talking about jobs to be done. But what you're describing there, we would describe as the hiring criteria. And so, you know, yeah, maybe somebody somewhere has heard, you know, if they're thinking about a mobile app, they've heard, you know, Mark Zuckerberg say something along the lines of, you know, we don't, you know, building hybrid apps was one of the worst mistakes we ever made. And so now this executive is thinking, well, we're not going to do a hybrid app. We're going to do a natively written app because they're faster or whatever. And so, yeah, to your point, absolutely. Sometimes the construction of that is important to people, and they include those sorts of things as their criteria for hiring a new solution. Or sometimes they use it as their criteria for firing. And so, you know, in the case of, you know, Facebook, they found that people were resisting using their mobile apps because they were not quite as responsive. And, you know, where a customer expects to be able to tap and they see, you know, they get an immediate response on the button, you know, with their hybrid apps, it was slower. And that was frustrating. But it wasn't frustrating in and of itself. You know, there wasn't someone that was, you know, sitting, you know, I imagine Jacob Nielsen, you know, with his with his stopwatch tapping the button and being like, oh, you've got a half a second latency. And there's, you know, there wasn't anyone at Facebook that was feeling angst over that. It was that they felt like their adoption rates weren't high enough. And so it became important for them, their hiring criteria and what they were going to use as their next solution had to say, you know, well, because we want, you know, people to be more engaged and using this and looking at this more so that we can sell more ads and so that we can, you know, create more loyal users, we need to have an app that's going to be responsive that people feel like they can trust when they use it. And that's cool. I mean, I think those are, like, to me, those are very exhilarating things, just on a personal and professional level. Those are exhilarating things to see. And the reason that I've been so, you know, become so attached and committed to Jobs to Be Done is that it's simply a tool for being able to get there and achieve those understandings both more reliably. You know, I feel very confident now when I'm working with the client that I understand exactly what it is they need, or if I'm doing Jobs to Be Done research for them, I understand their customers. I mean, it's so satisfying for me. I was with one of my favorite clients yesterday, and we were chatting, and, you know, he just made this sort of offhanded comment that, you know, it's almost a little bit scary when we're together because he feels like I understand his customers better than he does.
Which you might. I mean, there's probably a degree of truth to that, right? I mean, you come in it objectively. A lot of entrepreneurs have a very big attachment to their own business and think that they're incredible and amazing and everything else. But you kind of have that kind of, I'm assuming that kind of impartial, let's look objectively and let's look at your customers as they relate to you and your business.
Yeah. I see them. I'm able to, because I'm detached from the success of the product or service. I'm able really just to, you know, be curious and look at the customer, and the situation and the struggle that they're in. And here's the truth. As you start asking these questions, when you and I first started working together and you start talking about, you know, some of the Socratic questioning and asking these questions, I was like, there is no way someone's going to want to sit and have that type of conversation with me. But the truth is, it is so rare that someone sits across the table from you and expresses any interest in anything going on in your life. Like, people will just open up. If you have genuine interest and, you know, you're trying to do something to help them or to understand them, almost, you know, almost universally, people love that.
Well, and if you clarify it with, I'm asking you these questions, I mean, what I do is I say, the reason I need to know this data, and just to catch anyone up who on what Socratic questioning and all that means, one of the things I cover in Double Your Freelancing Rate is this idea that I actually got. So my background's in the classics. So I read a lot of Greek and Latin literature.
Really?
Yeah. No, that's where I got it from. And, you know, if you read the dialogues of Plato, they're fascinating because it's just this guy who, I mean, Socrates, who walks around Athens and he talks to people. And what's fascinating is his whole thing is, you know, say a problem is brought to, or a problem or an assumption is brought to the table. How can I not just try to jump to the end and say, all right, you know, tell me what the real deal is, but instead try to let people, I mean, he does it in a way to help people become more or less, I mean, there's a degree of sophistry in it, in that the, well, you know, his aim is to, let's say he wants to convince somebody of, you know, some in his mind, a universal truth. He will bring somebody's assumption and ask the right questions that drive the discussion to the person he's talking to having a self-realization. Because we all know that if Eric, you tell me, hey, you should vote for so-and-so. It's like, look at Facebook comment threads, right? Like, I mean, people, that doesn't work. But if instead you and I had a discussion and, you know, you asked me about, so what do I think of, you know, the state of the United States? And, you know, we start to discuss and blah, 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 blah. And you ask me, you feed me the right questions off of my answers that drive me to getting to the point of view that you want me to land at. I mean, that's the whole thing. Lawyers do it. Psychologists do it. I mean, this is something that's formally taught in law school, psychology school, or whatever it's called. And anyway, it's so powerful because what you're able to do is you're able to really, you know, peel away. All right, you know, yes, you're telling me you want a new website. Now let me ask you the right questions to figure out exactly what do you really want. You know, what is it that you actually want? Because it's not a website. You can say that all you want, but I know for a fact it's not a website, right? And you know, you start to develop this questioning system that helps you understand what is the actual thing they need, what is the actual problem they have now, and what do they realistically want tomorrow to potentially look like for them. And then my job from there on out is to say, how can I use my skills to get them there? That's it. I mean, that's the whole thing, right? And I mean, that's where road mapping comes in, because that's kind of a formal way of saying, all right, let's figure out how we're going to do that. Let's tie the two together. And that's really, I mean, that's the long and short of it, really, right? And it's just something that I think, you know, you just mentioned how people open up. When you show them that the reason you're doing this is because, first off, if you can technically succeed, but you can actually still fail, right? You can technically do the right work, but the business problem at hand is not solved. So it's really a failure. And on top of that, in my mind, I think we should always be looking at how can we be an investment to our clients? How do we show them, you know, why it's worthwhile to pay us money? And here's how they can make more money, you know, as a result of that. Until I know what's going on, I can't be an investment. I can't confidently say that, you know, I can actually help in a way that makes financial sense for them. So, you know, and so much of that, I mean, it all ties together, right? Like, jobs to be done, Socratic questioning, Greek dialogues written 2,500 years ago. Human nature hasn't changed at all. And it's important to understand this stuff. And we're not doing it to try to, you know, actually to go back to Plato. And one of the books is called this, or one of the dialogues is called The Sophist, where what ended up happening in Athens is you had this kind of class called the Sophists, which is where we get the word sophisticated from. And what they would do is they would go around and use this skill or this method and exploit it, you know, to get their way. It's like, imagine a politician, right? It's they're exploiting that base human psychology. And so, you know, I mean, in a way, yes, this could be dangerous. It could be something that it's I think we all cringe when we see these what we might call snake oil salespeople who are, you know, technically bereft of any skill, but they know how to play the game. They know how to, you know, say the right things and everything else. I think what I'm trying to achieve, and I think you're doing the same, is don't discredit tactics. Don't discredit that it works, or, you know, the method, I guess. But instead, how can we use that in a way that ends up delivering a better end result to our clients, a better product to our clients? And until you actually understand why somebody's switching, why is somebody firing their old workflow that they're doing in Excel or paper or whatever and coming to you, you don't have that big picture.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, to tie it back, you know, it's because then you really get a good understanding of what the value is in the situation. It helps you right size the project. It really helps you understand, you know, do people want it done faster, or do they want it done, you know, are they seeing this as a, you know, are they seeing this project as something that's going to get them by for 6 months until they sell their business, or are they planning for the next 30 years and they want, you know, software that's going to, you know, to last for that long? And that, you know, that really helps us frame, you know, what it is that we build, how we think about providing value for them, how we size the project. And I would think, I mean, I was curious if you ever find this when you do road mapping, but even if you want to do, even if you're the right person to do the project at all, because if it's not an expensive problem and you can't put together a solution for them that provides a level of value, then, you know, why do it? Everyone's going to be disappointed.
Right. And the solution should change based off of, like you just said, is this a 30-year plan or a 5-month plan or whatever? That's going to require a different end result, right? And if you're just going into this as an order taker, which I think a lot of freelancers think of themselves as, right? Like the client has come to me and said, here's what I need done. And then you jump into technician mode and say, all right, let's hash out how we're going to do it. The problem is, like we've been alluding to, until you have that full picture, you can still do the wrong thing. Which, do you really want to have a portfolio of failures? Even though they're successful, do you really want to have, I mean, successful clients refer, they come back for more, they make excellent case studies. I mean, you don't want a portfolio. I mean, my early years as an agency, we built these dumb social networks, dumb apps, and we just accepted them, right? And what ended up happening was later down the road, you know, we'd get people saying, hey, you know, can you show us a bit of what we've done? And, you know, I remember once we linked them to, not to call them out on the air, but yourgardenshow.com, which that was a big project of ours, big app, huge amounts of money spent, a lot of money raised. And if you go there now, it's basically like, you know, sorry, we're closed, or, you know, we, you know, it's one of those typical startup parting letters. But that's bad for me, right? I mean, if I would have been able to go back in time and say, okay, look, they're building a website for a social network for gardeners, which is already a lot of red flags start being raised when you say that, right? And then how can I, you know, how can I make it so they actually can make this a real thing, a business? You know, how, and you know, at the time I had my own business, I guess, you know, my consulting business, but I wasn't really thinking in terms of that my role was to get involved in my clients' businesses. But until I started doing that, it was this kind of like this endless loop of just, okay, what are we building? Okay, we're building the cat social network. Let's build the cat social network. And then, you know, and so on. And you don't want that. I mean, it's demoralizing. What's worse than having a bunch of stuff that you poured a lot of time and code into or design into or whatever it is you do and know that it's not being used because it didn't end up succeeding, even though you did everything right?
Yeah. So how did that impact you as far as, you know, do you feel like that helped you resist building a social network for freelancers?
Yeah, I mean, so right now, for instance, I'm doing the, if you actually go back and look at every email I've sent, like when I did the first DYFC, right, it was literally sold over email with no sales page, no real upfront anything, just to really verify, is this something that people want, right? I mean, that's what I needed. But to get there, and I think you'll find this fascinating, one of the things I do is, so say somebody joins my email course or just my newsletter outright, I ask them to tell me, like my email course in particular. So it's a course called Charge What You're Worth. And, you know, the opt-in page has, it's pretty light because I'm not selling anything. It's just a opt-in page for an email address. But what I do in the very first thing when somebody goes to the click on that first worksheet I send out is I ask them, what is one thing you need this course to help you solve? And what I've done is I have thousands of submissions that have come in from this, and I look for trends. And then what I do is, as I get these trends, I regularly, I mean, a lot of people don't know this, I'll jump on a Skype call with somebody who joined like an hour ago. I'll just email them. Yeah. Hey, would you mind if, I do that with DYFR sales. I've done it with DYFC. I do it with even my free email course. And yeah, I mean, I just want to know, what is it like, what, you know, why, right? Like, you know, why did you decide in this case, why did you decide to give me your email address and to say, I'm willing to spend a little time reading your emails? You know, what is it? What's going on? What is that thing you need done? And that is, I mean, I've continuously refining it because I'm learning. I mean, and that's, I think that's what we all need to be doing.
That's awesome. Do you find like, so are people, what percentage of people respond to your request for a Skype call?
It's actually pretty, it depends on how long it's been since they opted in. If it's the same day, it's usually about 50-50. I mean, honestly, like they're more, it's more of like a, like, oh wow, there's actually a human being on the end of this. I mean, people find it fascinating when I actually, when they respond to an autoresponder and then I respond back from Gmail, like people, you know, it's right. Like, you know, yeah. And I think it works. But you know, one of the things I've done is, you know, I used to have, or I still do in my newsletter, the first email that goes out, it's a reply and tell me something, right? Reply and I don't like, one thing I don't like, if you want to get involved in any of this, is the reply and, you know, like the open-ended thing. Like you should have a very specific thing that you're asking for. So like, what's one thing that you're struggling with right now that I can help you with? You know, that doesn't require somebody to think a lot. But if instead you say, you know, what can I help you with? And it's an open-ended thing. The uptake rate is not nearly what it could be. But here's how I do it with the email course. So the email course has worksheets attached to each lesson. And you go to the first worksheet. And it has the goal of these worksheets is to apply what you just learned in the course to your business. But one of the questions is kind of a curveball question. It doesn't really fit in. But people are already filling out the thing. So they fill out that question. And that's the one where that's a question for my usage. It is for them too, because I mean, the way I phrase it is, look, I want to make sure that I'm covering the right stuff, that I'm saying the right things. And it's been really, really helpful. I mean, on all fronts, whether it's ultimate conversions or the success people get after going through. Because at the end, I ask them again, did I, you know, think back to the thing you said you needed in that first worksheet? Has that been it? Have I accomplished that? And if not, why? If yet, yes, tell me what the big revelation has been. And that doing it sounds stupid and simple, and it is, but it is so effective. I mean, that's probably some of the most valuable data I have.
Yeah, because you're coming across and people get the sense that you're coming across and meeting them where they are, and from that perspective, then taking them on a journey. They're not having to be the ones that, you know, you use those examples of those two questions, and I don't. I'm going to use the word lazy. Like the one is lazy, not in that there's some character flaw in the person that asks it, but it's putting all the work on the customer to think through. Like, okay, well, what's going on? You know, when you ask the question about what were the two questions again? You said one was, what are you struggling with?
In the worksheet number one for the email course.
Yeah, you're sort of talking about like I ask this more closed-ended question.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, what I tell them there is I say, what is one thing that you need this email course to solve for you for it to be worthwhile?
That is a great question, because then that just like immediately, like I think of you asking me that question, like that just thrusts me into, or it's so evocative, and it just gets me thinking about, well, what do I really want? You know, why did I get, you know, I saw Brennan's ad on Clients from Hell, and I clicked on it, and I got here, and then he had this button to opt me in on this course. Yeah, like why, you know, why I did, and then, you know, like it helps you be so present in your situation when you ask a question like that. That's awesome.
Right. And well, another thing is these people don't know me. I mean, a lot of this is now even coming from, I've done Facebook ads that are driving people to this. So these are totally like they haven't heard my podcast, they haven't seen my site, they haven't done any of this probably. So it's really important for me to try to figure out early on, you know, like sometimes I try to piece out of that, like what are objections that they might have had? Maybe they overcame it, but if they overcame it, how many people didn't? Like what objections did, you know, if this was something that was holding, I mean, it's not as much for the email course, but it's a big deal for like double your freelancing rate, right? Where people are a little more methodical about whether or not, you know, it's much different paying versus email entry. So, you know, I try to really figure out what are the objections that, you know, held somebody back, and any objection that comes up in my mind is a bug. I mean, this is a bug in my sales and marketing, and it should be. I mean, that's the attitude, I think, no matter what you're doing. You know, if you're doing anything that involves B2B transactions, you need to be thinking like this.
Yeah. So I love you. I've heard you use that phrasing before, and I think that's so, I encourage technology people to think that way, because I think that that's a that's a real unique perspective on marketing that I don't know a lot of, you know, just more traditional marketers, but I think that's a, you know, as a software person, as a technology person comes into, you know, because I think your part of your journey is moving from being a more technical person to being more of a marketing person. And I think it's that background that lends itself very nicely to having that attitude about the page rather than being sensitive about people don't like my copywriting or they don't like the format. It's a bug. And as a bug is an easy thing to identify. It's an easy thing to fix. And I think that separates you from, you know, a lot of, it gives you a unique perspective on marketing, I guess is my perception.
Well, I mean, here's the thing, like as my background being an engineer, you know, we all know you never build an app, let's say, that is correct day one. There's always going to be issues. And those issues, and also the code you write is written with an end goal in mind, which is some functionality that the product should do, right? Like the app should do this. And the app is also going to have issues with it. So I look at marketing, like you just said, the exact same way, where the first cut's always going to be bad. And it's up to me to aggressively and proactively figure out what are the, because the problem with marketing is it's a monologue typically, right? It's, I mean, that's the issue. That's one thing, honestly, that I don't think a lot of freelancers think about and consultants think about is we have to our advantage that most of our marketing happens as a dialogue, most of our sales happen as a dialogue where you're talking with somebody in a meeting. A lot of us don't like that. We want to have the low touch, sales stuff going on, but that's a huge advantage because if you know how to ask the right questions and everything else, you can learn so much that will help you the next time you need to sell.
So I know we're really long on this, but can I give you a real practical example? And like, I think something that helped me start to really understand, the exact point that you're making. I think sometimes it's easiest for us sometimes to, there's a lot of self-consciousness, I think, that can be tied up if we want to start, you know, applying more of a jobs to be done thinking to what the service that we offer. That sometimes can be really hard because there's just a lot of identity wrapped up in it. It feels like there's a lot of risk too. So what I really encourage people to do is to think about, to look at situations where you've been extremely satisfied with service and kind of unwind that. So I had a recent experience. There's a car repair shop in Indianapolis where I live called Church Brothers. And my car had gotten hit in a parking lot. I exchanged insurance information with the person, and I was really busy and I was really stressed out during this time. And, you know, I was kind of like, man, this just stinks because now I've got a lot of extra work that I have to do. So, I waited for a few days and I finally end up over at Church Brothers on a recommendation. And this guy, Dave, walks out and, you know, he comes and looks at the car and, you know, sort of empathizes with me like, oh yeah, that looks like you got hit pretty good. And he's like, okay, here's what's going to happen. You are going to give me this person's insurance information, and then you're going to drive home. I'm going to work things out with the insurance people. I'm going to call you in about 7 days when I have things worked out. You're going to come, and you're going to park your car right here in this parking spot. There's going to be a rental car waiting for you right here in this parking spot. I'm going to hand you the key. You're going to drive off. I'm going to fix your car. I'm going to deal with the insurance company. I'm going to call you about 7 days later. You're going to come back. You're going to park the rental car here. I'm going to hand you your key, and you're going to drive off. And I was like, man, that guy is – I mean, he just really gets my situation, and he has engineered his service to meet my exact situation. I'm sure there's nothing unique whatsoever about me, but he was just they had spent enough time just looking at the situations that cause people to come in there and then designing their service around it. That I was like, that was just perfect. And it resonated so much with me about like the work that they did to understand what was really motivating people to come in and get their car fixed, the types of situations, and then just, you know, engineering a solution around that. I was like, that is just really smart. And that's a good way for me to sort of take what I can learn from them and apply that to my own business.
Right. And I mean, unfortunately we need to close up the interview, but the thing I want to say though is, by doing that, yes, you're going to get more sales. You're going to get more conversions when you think about it that way. You're going to get people who they're going to treat you better than they would otherwise because they're going to look at you as more of an ally slash partner versus a doer, you know, like what I like to call a hammer swinger. But on top of that, it's a more, I mean, you're offering a premium product, which means you can justify a premium price point. And that's the big thing. And I think that's the core of double your freelancing rate. That's the core of the jobs you've done. That's everything. And it's just, honestly, like that's why I do a lot of what I do, is because I realize that when you do that, how much better everything is, both for your clients and you. I think a lot of us think it like, oh, if I charge more, I'm screwing over my clients. I mean, a big thing is when you say you're going to, like, how do you raise rates on existing clients? What I tell people is, well, give them a better product and show them why it's worth more, and then go from there. I mean, it's not, if you just say, yeah, starting tomorrow, you're going to get the same thing, but it's twice the price. That's the problem. So Eric, besides coming to see you, you talk at length about this in Stockholm this June at the W Freelancing Conference. Where else can people find out more about you and what you're up to?
So I'm on Twitter at Eric M. White. That's M as in Matthew. Eric M. White on Twitter. I do talk about jobs to be done quite a bit there, and it's a great community. Also, my website. I set up a page. I assume this is okay. I've set up a page for people that might happen to be listening to this particular podcast. Just sort of some next steps for, you know, maybe, you know, ways that you can start to understand the jobs to be done that you can do or that people are hiring you for. So just some materials to get started on that at my website, which is thinkmotile.com. That's thinkmotile.com and then /BOF for a business of freelancing. So thinkmotile.com/BOF.
Perfect. Thank you, Eric.
Yeah, thank you, Brennan. Always great to talk to you.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Eric. If you are going to be at or can get to the European conference this year, that's going to be in June in Stockholm. Eric is actually going to be speaking, which I hinted at in the interview. So he's one of the headline speakers. And be sure to grab your ticket. Obviously, if this is past June, you're kind of out of luck. But if you're listening before June of 2016, head on over to doubleyourfreelancing.com/EUConf. And you can find all the details for registration there. Also, keep on your radar if you're in North America. We've got the next Double Your Freelancing Conference North America happening September 28th through 30th. No registration details are opened up yet, but keep it on your calendar because I know last year at least, got a lot of feedback from people who wanted to go, but they had existing commitments. So get that in your calendar now so you don't let it get overridden with anything else. All right, we'll see you next time for another interview, another episode rather, interview 2 of The Business of Freelancing.